Bristow and Robin kept smiling weakly until the door had closed completely, then exchanged looks of relief. The barman had disappeared. Only four of them were left in the little lounge now. Strike became aware for the first time of the 80s ballad playing in the background. Jennifer Rush, The Power of Love. Bristow and Robin approached their table.
"I thought you wanted to speak to Rochelle's aunt," asked Bristow, looking aggrieved, as though he had been through an ordeal for nothing.
"Not enough to chase after her," replied Strike cheerfully. "You can fill me in."
Strike could tell, by the expressions on Robin's and Bristow's faces, that both thought his attitude strangely lackadaisical. Alison was fumbling for something in her bag, her own face hidden. The rain had stopped. The pavements were slippery, and the sky was gloomy, threatening a fresh downpour. The two women walked ahead in silence, while Bristow earnestly related to Strike all that he could remember of Aunt Winifred's conversation. Strike, however, was not listening. He was watching the backs of the two women, both in black, almost, to the careless observer, alike, interchangeable. He remembered the sculptures on either side of the Queen's Gate, not identical at all, in spite of the assumptions made by lazy eyes. One male, one female. The same species, yes, but profoundly different. When he saw Robin and Alison come to a halt beside a BMW he assumed must be Bristow's, he too slowed up, and cut across Bristow's rambling recital of Rochelle's stormy relations with her family.
"John, I need to check something with you."
"Far away."
"You say you heard your uncle come into your mother's flat on the morning before Lula died?"
"Yep, that's right."
"You are absolutely sure that the man you heard was Tony?"
"Yes, of course."
"You didn't see him, though?"
"I..."
Bristow's rabbity face was suddenly puzzled.
"No, I don't think I actually saw him. But I heard him let himself in. I heard his voice from the hall."
"You don't think that perhaps because you were expecting Tony, you assumed it was Tony?"
Another pause.
Then, in a changed voice,
"Are you saying Tony wasn't there?"
"I just want to know how certain you are that he was."
"Well,
until this moment I was completely certain. Nobody else has got a key to my mother's flat.
It couldn't have been anyone except Tony."
"So you heard someone let themselves into the flat? You heard a male voice? Was he talking to your mother or to Lula?"
Bristow's large front teeth were much in evidence as he pondered the question.
"I heard him come in. I think I heard him speaking to Lula."
"And you heard him leave?"
"Yes. I heard him walk down the hall. I heard the door close."
"When Lula said goodbye to you, did she make any mention of Tony having just been there?"
More silence. Bristow raised a hand to his mouth, thinking.
She hugged me. That's all I... Yes. I think she said she'd spoken to Tony, or did she? Did I assume she'd spoken to him because I thought... But if it wasn't my uncle, who was it?"
Strike waited. Bristow stared at the pavement, thinking.
But it must have been him. Lula must have seen whoever it was, and not thought their presence remarkable. And who else could that have been except Tony? Who else would have had a key?
"How many keys are there?"
"Four, three spares."
"That's a lot."
"Well, Lula and Tony and I all had one. Mum liked us all to be able to let ourselves in and out, especially while she'd been ill."
"And all these keys are present and accounted for, are they?"
"Yes, well, I think so. I assume Lula's came back to my mother with all her other things. Tony's still got his, I've got mine. And my mother's. I expect it's somewhere in the flat."
"So you aren't aware of any key that's been lost?"
"No."
"And none of you has ever lent your key to anyone?"
"My God, why would we do that?"
"I keep remembering how that file of photographs was removed from Lula's laptop while it was in your mother's flat. If there's another key floating around..."
"There can't be," said Bristow. "This is... I... Why are you saying Tony wasn't there? He must have been. He says he saw me through the door."
You went into the office on the way back from Lula's, right?
Yes.
To get files?
Yes. I just ran in and grabbed them. I was quick.
So you were back at your mother's house... It can't have been later than 10. And the man who came in, when did he arrive?
Maybe half an hour afterwards. I can't honestly remember. I wasn't watching the clock. But why would Tony say he was there if he wasn't?
Well, if he knew you'd been working at home, he could easily say that he came in and didn't want to disturb you, and just walked down the hall to speak to your mother. She, presumably, confirmed his presence to the police.
I suppose so. Yes, I think so.
But you're not sure?
I don't think we've ever discussed it. Mum was groggy and in pain. She slept a lot that day. And then the next morning we had the news about Lula.
But you've never thought it was strange that Tony didn't come into the study and speak to you?
It wasn't strange at all, said Bristow. He was in a foul temper about the Conway Oates business. I'd have been more surprised if he had been chatty.
John, I don't want to alarm you, but I think that both you and your mother could be in danger. Bristow's little bleat of nervous laughter sounded thin and unconvincing. Strike could see Alison standing 50 yards away, her arms folded, ignoring Robin, watching the two men.
You can't be serious, said Bristow.
I'm very serious.
But does... Cormoran, are you saying you know who killed Lula?
Yeah, I think I do. But I still need to speak to your mother before we wrap this up. Bristow looked as though he wished he could drink the contents of Strike's mind. His myopic eyes scanned every inch of Strike's face, his expression half afraid, half imploring.
I must be there, he said. She's very weak.
Of course. How about tomorrow morning?
Tony will be livid if I take off any more time during work hours.
Strike waited.
All right, said Bristow. All right. 10:30 tomorrow.
Chapter 14. The following morning was fresh and bright. Strike took the underground to genteel and leafy Chelsea. This was a part of London that he barely knew, for Leda had never, even in her most spendthrift phases, managed to secure a toehold in the vicinity of the Royal Chelsea Hospital, pale and gracious in the spring sun. Franklin Row was an attractive street of more red brick. Here were plane trees and a great grassy space bordered with railings in which a throng of primary school children were playing games in pale blue Airtex tops and navy blue shorts, watched by their track-suited teachers. Their happy cries punctuated the sedate quiet otherwise disturbed only by birdsong. No cars passed as Strike strolled down the pavement towards the house of Lady Yvette Bristow, his hands in his pockets. The wall beside the partly glass door, set at the top of 4 white stone steps, bore an old-fashioned Baker-like panel of doorbells. Strike checked to see that Lady Yvette Bristow's name was clearly marked beside flat E. Then he retreated to the pavement and stood waiting in the gentle warmth of the day, looking up and down the street. 10:30 arrived, but John Bristow did not. The square remained deserted, but for the 20 small children running between hoops and coloured cones beyond the railings. At 10:45, Strike's mobile vibrated in his pocket. The text was from Robin. Alison has just called to say that J.B. is unavoidably detained. He does not want you to speak to his mother without him present. Strike immediately texted Bristow. How long are you likely to be detained? Any chance of doing this later today? He had barely sent the message when the phone began to ring.
Yeah, hello, said Strike.
Oggy!
Came Graham Hardacre's tinny voice, all the way from Germany.
I've got the stuff on Agumon.
Your timing's uncanny.
Strike pulled out his notebook.
Go on.
He's Lieutenant Jonah Francis Agumon, Royal Engineers.
Age 21, unmarried, last tour of duty started 11th of January. He's back in June. Next of kin, a mother. No siblings, no kids.
Strike scribbled it all down in his notebook, with a mobile phone held between jaw and shoulder.
"I owe you one, Hardy," he said, putting the notebook away. "Haven't got a picture, have you? I could email you one."
Strike gave Hardacre the office email address, and, after routine inquiries about each other's lives and mutual expressions of goodwill, terminated the call. It was 5 to 11. Strike waited, phone in hand, in the peaceful leafy square, while the gambling children played with their hoops and their beanbags, and a tiny silver plane drew a thick white line across the periwinkle sky. At last, with a small chirrup clearly audible in the quiet street, Bristow's texted reply arrived. "No chance today. I've been forced to go out to Rye. Maybe tomorrow?" Strike sighed.
"Sorry, John," he muttered.
And he climbed the steps and rang Lady Bristow's doorbell. The entrance hall, quiet, spacious and sunny, nevertheless had a faintly depressing air of communality that a bucket-shaped vase of dried flowers and a dull green carpet and pale yellow walls, probably chosen for their inoffensiveness, could not dissipate. As at Kentigern Gardens, there was a lift, this one with wooden doors. Strike chose to walk upstairs. The building had a faint shabbiness that in no way diminished its quiet aura of wealth. The door of the top flat was opened by the smiling West Indian Macmillan nurse who had buzzed him through the front door.
"You're not Mr. Bristow?" she said brightly.
"No, I'm Cormoran Strike. John's on his way."
She let him in. Lady Bristow's hallway was pleasantly cluttered, papered in faded red, and covered in watercolours in old gilt frames. An umbrella stand was full of walking sticks, and coats hung on a row of pegs. Strike glanced right, and saw a sliver of the study at the end of the corridor, a heavy wooden desk and a swivel chair with its back to the door.
"Will you wait in the sitting room while I check whether Lady Bristow is ready to see you?"
"Yeah, of course."
He walked through the door she indicated, into a charming room with primrose walls, lined with bookcases bearing photographs. An old-fashioned dial telephone sat on an end table beside a comfortable chintz-covered sofa. Strike checked that the nurse was out of sight before slipping the receiver off the hook and repositioning it, unobtrusively skewed on its rests. Close by the bay window, on a bonheur du jour, stood a large photograph, framed in silver, showing the wedding of Sir and Lady Alec Bristow. The groom looked much older than his wife, a rotund, beaming, bearded man. The bride was thin, blonde and pretty, in an insipid way. Ostensibly admiring the photograph, Strike stood with his back to the door and slid open a little drawer in the delicate cherrywood desk. Inside was a supply of fine, pale blue writing paper and matching envelopes. He slid the drawer shut again.
"Mr. Strike, you can come through."
Back through the red-papered hall, a short passage, and into a large bedroom, where the dominant colours were duck-egg blue and white, and everywhere gave an impression of elegance and taste. Two doors on the left, both ajar, led to a small ensuite bathroom and what seemed to be a large walk-in wardrobe. The furniture was delicate and Frenchified, the props of serious illness, the drip on its metal stand, the bedpan lying clean and shiny on a chest of drawers with an array of medications, were glaring impostors. The dying woman wore a thick ivory-coloured bed jacket and reclined, dwarfed by her carved wooden bed, on many white pillows. No trace of Lady Bristow's youthful prettiness remained. The raw bones of the skeleton were clearly delineated now, beneath fine skin that was shiny and flaking. Her eyes were sunken, filmy and dim, and her wispy hair, fine as a baby's, was grey against large expanses of pink scalp. Her emaciated arms lay limp on top of the covers, a catheter protruded. Her death was an almost palpable presence in the room, as though it stood waiting patiently, politely, behind the curtains. A faint smell of lime blossom pervaded the atmosphere, but did not entirely eclipse that of disinfectant and bodily decay, smells that recalled, to Strike, the hospital where he had lain helpless for months. A second large bay window had been raised a few inches, so that the warm fresh air and the distant cries of sports-playing children could enter the room. The view was of the topmost branches of the leafy, sunlit plane trees.
"Are you the detective?"
Her voice was thin and cracked, her words slightly slurred. Strike, who had wondered whether Bristow had told her the truth about his profession, was glad that she knew.
"Yes, I'm Cormoran Strike."
"Where's John?"
"He's been held up at the office."
"Again?"
she murmured, and then,
"Tony works him very hard. It isn't fair."
She peered at him blurrily and indicated a small painted chair with one slightly raised finger.
"Do you sit down?"
There were chalky white lines around her faded irises. As he sat, Strike noticed two more silver-framed photographs standing on the bedside table. With something akin to an electric shock, he found himself looking into the eyes of 10-year-old Charlie Bristow, chubby-faced, with his slightly mullety haircut, frozen forever in the '80s, his school shirt with its long pointed collar and the huge knot in his tie. He looked just as he had when he had waved goodbye to his best friend, Cormoran Strike, expecting to meet each other again after Easter. Beside Charlie's photograph was a smaller one, of an exquisite little girl with long black ringlets and big brown eyes, in a navy blue school uniform. Lula Landry, age no more than 6.
"Mary,"
said Lady Bristow, without raising her voice, and the nurse bustled over.
"Could you get Mr. Strike coffee, tea?"
she asked him. And he was transported back 2.5 decades to Charlie Bristow's sunlit garden and the gracious blonde mother and the iced lemonade.
"A coffee would be great, thank you very much."
"I do apologize for not making it myself,"
said Lady Bristow, as the nurse departed with heavy footfalls.
"But as you can see, I am entirely dependent now on the kindness of strangers, like poor Blanche Dubois."
She closed her eyes for a moment, as though to concentrate better on some internal pain. He wondered how heavily medicated she was. Beneath the gracious manner, he divined the faintest whiff of something bitter in her words, much as the lime blossom failed to cover the smell of decay, and he wondered at it, considering that Bristow spent most of his time dancing attendance on her.
"Why isn't John here?"
asked Lady Bristow again, with her eyes still shut.
"He's been held up at the office," repeated Strike.
"Oh, yes, yes, you said.
Lady Bristow, I'd like to ask you a few questions, and I apologize in advance if they seem over-personal or distressing."
"When you have been through what I have," she said quietly, "nothing much can hurt you any more. Do call me Yvette."
"Thank you. Do you mind if I take notes?"
"No, not at all," she said.
And she watched him take out his pen and notebook with a dim show of interest.
"I'd like to start, if you don't mind, with how Lula came into your family. Did you know anything about her background when you adopted her?"
She looked the very picture of helplessness and passivity, lying there with her limp arms on the covers.
"No,"
she said.
"I didn't know anything. Alec might have known, but if he did, he never told me."
"What makes you think your husband knew something?"
"Alec always went into things as deeply as he could,"
she said, with a faint, reminiscent smile.
"He was a very successful businessman, you know."
"But he never told you anything about Lula's first family?"
"Oh, no. He wouldn't have done that."
She seemed to find this a strange suggestion.
"I wanted her to be mine, just mine, you see. Alec would have wanted to protect me, if he knew anything. I could not have borne the idea that somebody out there might come and claim her one day. I had already lost Charlie, and I wanted a daughter so badly. The idea of losing her, too."
The nurse returned, bearing a tray with 2 cups on it and a plate of chocolate bourbons.
"One coffee," she said cheerfully, placing it beside Strike on the nearer of the bedside tables, "and 1 chamomile tea."
She bustled out again, Lady Bristow closed her eyes. Strike took a gulp of black coffee and said, "Lula went looking for her biological parents in the year before she died, didn't she?"
"That's right," said Lady Bristow, with her eyes still closed. "I had just been diagnosed with cancer."
There was a pause, in which Strike put down his coffee cup with a soft chink, and the distant cheers of the small children in the square outside floated through the open window.
"John and Tony were very, very angry with her," said Lady Bristow. "They didn't think she ought to have started trying to find her biological mother when I was so very ill. The tumour was already advanced when they found it. I had to go straight on to chemotherapy. John was very good. He drove me back and forth to the hospital and came to stay with me during the worst bits. And even Tony rallied round, but all Lula seemed to care about."
She sighed and opened her faded eyes, seeking Strike's face.
"Tony always said that she was very spoiled. I dare say it was my fault. I had lost Charlie, you see. I couldn't do enough for her."
"Do you know how much Lula managed to find out about her birth family?"
"No, I don't, I'm afraid. I think she knew how much it upset me. She didn't tell me a great deal. I know that she found the mother, of course, because there was all the dreadful publicity. She was exactly what Tony had predicted. She hadn't ever wanted Lula. An awful, awful woman,"
whispered Lady Bristow.
"But Lula kept seeing her. I was having chemotherapy all through that time. I lost my hair."
Her voice trailed away. Strike felt, as perhaps she meant him to, like a brute as he pressed on.
"What about her biological father? Did she ever tell you she'd found out anything about him?"
"No,"
said Lady Bristow weakly.
"I didn't ask. I had the impression that she had given up on the whole business once she found that horrible mother. I didn't want to discuss it, any of it. It was too distressing. I think she realized that."
"She didn't mention her biological father the last time you saw her," Strike pressed on.
"Oh, no,"
she said in her soft voice.
"No. That was not a very long visit, you know. She told me the moment she arrived, I remember, that she could not stay long. She had to meet her friend, Chiara Porter."
Her sense of ill usage wafted gently towards him, like the smell of the bedridden she exuded, a little fusty, a little overripe. Something about her recalled Rochelle, although they were as different as two women could be. Both gave off the resentment of those who feel short-changed and neglected. "Can you remember what you and Lula talked about that day?"
"Well, I had been given so many painkillers, you understand. I had had a very serious operation. I can't remember every detail."
"But you remember Lula coming to see you?" asked Strike.
"Oh, yes," she said. "She woke me up. I had been sleeping."
"Can you remember what you talked about?"
"My operation, of course," she said,
with just a touch of asperity.
"And then a little bit about her big brother."
"Her big...
Charlie,"
said Lady Bristow pitifully.
"I told her about the day he died. I'd never really talked to her about it before. The worst. The very worst day of my life."
Strike could imagine her, prostrate and a little groggy, but no less resentful for all that, holding her unwilling daughter there at her side by talking about her pain and her dead son.
"How could I have known that that would be the last time I would ever see her?"
breathed Lady Bristow.
"I didn't realize that I was about to lose a second child."
Her bloodshot eyes filled. She blinked, and two fat tears fell down onto her hollow cheeks.
"Could you please look in that drawer?"
she whispered, pointing a withered finger at the bedside table.
"And get me out my pills."
Strike slid it open and saw many white boxes inside, of varying types and with various labels upon them.
"Which?"
"It doesn't matter. They're all the same.
she said. He took one out. It was clearly labelled Valium. She had enough in there to overdose 10 times.
"If you could pop a couple out for me," she said, "I'll take them with some tea, if it's cool enough."
He handed her her pills and the cup. Her hands trembled. He had to support the saucer, and he thought, inappropriately, of a priest offering communion.
"Thank you,"
she murmured, relaxing back onto her pillows as he replaced her tea on the table and fixing him with her plaintive eyes.
"Didn't John tell me you knew Charlie?"
"Yes, I did," said Strike. "I've never forgotten him."
"No, of course not. He was a most lovable child. Everyone always said so. The sweetest boy, the very sweetest I have ever known. I miss him every single day."
Outside the window, the children shrieked, and the plane trees rustled, and Strike thought of how the room would have looked on a winter morning months ago, when the trees must have been bare-limbed, when Lula Landry had sat where he was sitting, with her beautiful eyes perhaps fixed on the picture of dead Charlie, while her groggy mother told the horrible story.
"I had never really talked to Lula about it before. The boys had gone out on their bikes. We heard John screaming and then Tony shouting. Shouting."
Strike's pen had not made contact with paper yet. He watched the dying woman's face as she talked.
"Alec wouldn't let me look. Wouldn't let me anywhere near the quarry. When he told me what had happened, I fainted. I thought I would die. I wanted to die. I could not understand how God could have let it happen. But since then, I've come to think that perhaps I have deserved all of it,"
said Lady Bristow distantly, her eyes fixed on the ceiling.
"I've wondered whether I'm being punished. Because I love them too much. I spoiled them. I couldn't say no. Charlie, Alec, and Lula. I think it must be punishment. Because otherwise it would be too unspeakably cruel, wouldn't it? To make me go through it again and again and again."
Strike had no answer to give. She invited pity, but he found he could not pity her, even as much as perhaps she deserved. She lay dying, wrapped in invisible robes of martyrdom, presenting her helplessness and passivity to him like adornments, and his dominant feeling was distaste.
"I wanted Lula so much," said Lady Bristow. "But I don't think she ever... She was a darling little thing, so beautiful. I would have done anything for that girl. But she didn't love me the way Charlie and John loved me. Maybe it was too late. Maybe we got her too late. John was jealous when she first came to us. He had been devastated about Charlie. But they ended up being very close friends. Very close."
A tiny frown crumpled the paper-fine skin of her forehead.
"So Tony was quite wrong."
"What was he wrong about?" asked Strike quietly. Her fingers twitched upon the covers. She swallowed.
"Tony didn't think we should have adopted Lula."
"Why not?" asked Strike.
"Tony never liked any of my children," said Yvette Bristow. "My brother is a very hard man, very cold. He said dreadful things after Charlie died. Alec hit him. It wasn't true. It wasn't true, what Tony said."
Her milky gaze slid to Strike's face, and he thought he glimpsed the woman she must have been when she still had her looks. A little clingy, a little childish, prettily dependent, an ultra-feminine creature, protected and petted by Sir Alec, who strove to satisfy her every whim and wish.
"What did Tony say?"
"Horrible things about John and Charlie, awful things. I don't," she said weakly, "want to repeat them." "And then he phoned Alec when he heard that we were adopting a little girl, and told him we ought not to do it. Alec was furious," she whispered. "He forbade Tony our house." Did you tell Lula about all this when she visited that day? Asked Strike.
About Tony and the things he said after Charlie died. And when you adopted her.
She seemed to sense a reproach.
I can't remember exactly what I said to her. I had just had a very serious operation. I was a little drowsy from all the drugs. I can't remember precisely what I said now.
And then, with an abrupt change of subject,
that boy reminded me of Charlie, Lula's boyfriend, the very handsome boy. What's his name?
Evan Duffield.
That's right. He came to see me a little while ago, you know. Quite recently. I don't know exactly. I lose track of time. They give me so many drugs now. But he came to see me. It was so sweet of him. He wanted to talk about Lula.
Strike remembered Bristow's assertion that his mother had not known who Duffield was, and he wondered whether Lady Bristow had played this little game with her son, making herself out to be more confused than she really was, to stimulate his protective instincts.
Charlie would have been handsome like that, if he'd lived. He might have been a singer or an actor. He loved performing, do you remember? I felt very sorry for that boy, Evan. He cried here with me. He told me that he thought she was meeting another man.
What other man was that?
The singer,
said Lady Bristow vaguely.
The singer who'd written songs about her. When you're young and beautiful, you can be very cruel. I felt very sorry for him. He told me he felt guilty. I told him he had nothing to feel guilty about.
Why did he say he felt guilty?
For not following her into her apartment. For not being there to stop her dying.
If we could just go back for a moment, Yvette, to the day before Lula's death. She looked reproachful.
I'm afraid I can't remember anything else. I've told you everything I remember. I was just out of hospital. I was not myself. They'd given me so many drugs for the pain.
I understand that. I just wanted to know whether you remember your brother, Tony, visiting you that day.
There was a pause, and Strike saw something harden in the weak face.
No, I don't remember Tony coming,
said Lady Bristow at last.
I know he says he was here, but I don't remember him coming. Maybe I was asleep.
He claims to have been here when Lula was visiting, said Strike. Lady Bristow gave the smallest shrug of her fragile shoulders.
Maybe he was here, she said, but I don't remember it.
And then, her voice rising,
my brother's being much nicer to me now, he knows that I'm dying. He visits a lot now, always putting down poison about John, of course. He's always done that. But John has always been very good to me. He has done things for me while I've been ill, things no son should have to do. It would have been more appropriate for Lula, but she was a spoiled girl. I loved her, but she could be selfish, very selfish.
So on that last day, the last time you saw Lula, said Strike, returning doggedly to the main point, but Lady Bristow cut across him.
After she left, I was very upset, she said. Very upset indeed. Talking about Charlie always does that to me. She could see how distressed I was, but she still left to meet her friend. I had to take pills, and I slept. No, I never saw Tony. I didn't see anyone else. He might say he was here, but I don't remember anything until John woke me up with a supper tray. John was cross. He told me off.
Why was that?
He thinks I take too many pills,
said Lady Bristow, like a little girl.
I know he wants the best for me, poor John, but he doesn't realize. He couldn't. I've had so much pain in my life. He sat with me for a long time that night. We talked about Charlie. We talked into the early hours of the morning. And while we were talking, she said, dropping her voice to a whisper, at the very time we were talking, Lula fell. She fell off the balcony.
So it was John who had to break the news to me the next morning. The police had arrived on the doorstep at the crack of dawn. He came into the bedroom to tell me, and...
She swallowed and shook her head, limp, barely alive.
That's why the cancer came back. I know it. People can only bear so much pain.
Her voice was becoming more slurred. He wondered how much Valium she had already taken as she closed her eyes drowsily.
Yvette, would it be all right if I used your bathroom? He asked.
She assented with a sleepy nod. Strike got up and moved quickly and surprisingly quietly for a man of his bulk into the walk-in wardrobe. The space was lined with mahogany doors that reached to the ceiling. Strike opened one of the doors and glanced inside, at overstuffed railings of dresses and coats, with a shelf of bags and hats above, breathing in the musty smell of old shoes and fabric, which, in spite of the evident costliness of the contents, evoked an old charity shop. Silently, he opened and closed door after door, until on the fourth attempt, he saw a cluster of clearly brand new handbags, each of a different colour, that had been squeezed onto the high shelf. He took down the blue one, shot new and shiny. Here was the GS logo and the silk lining that was zipped into the bag. He ran his fingers around it, into every corner, then replaced it deftly on the shelf. He selected the white bag next. The lining was patterned with a stylized African print. Again he ran his fingers all around the interior. Then he unzipped the lining. It came out, just as Chiara had described, like a metal-edged scarf, exposing the rough interior of the white leather. Nothing was visible inside until he looked more closely. And then he saw the line of pale blue, running down the side of the stiff rectangular cloth-covered board holding the base of the bag in shape. He lifted up the board and saw, beneath it, a folded piece of pale blue paper, scribbled all over in an untidy hand. Strike replaced the bag swiftly on the shelf with the lining bundled inside, and took from an inside pocket of his jacket a clear plastic bag, into which he inserted the pale blue paper, shaken open but unread. He closed the mahogany door and continued to open others. Behind the penultimate door was a safe, operated by a digital keypad. Strike took a second plastic bag from inside his jacket, slid it over his hand, and began to press keys. But before he had completed his trial, he heard movement outside. Hastily thrusting the crumpled bag back into a pocket, he closed the wardrobe door as quietly as possible and walked back into the bedroom to find the Macmillan nurse bending over Yvette Bristow. She looked around when she heard him.
"Wrong door," said Strike. "I thought it was the bathroom."
He went into the small ensuite, and here, with the door closed, before flushing the toilet and turning on the taps for the nurse's benefit, he read the last will and testament of Lula Landry, scribbled on her mother's writing paper, and witnessed by Rochelle Onifade. Yvette Bristow was still lying with her eyes closed when he returned to the bedroom.
"She's asleep," said the nurse gently. "She does this a lot."
"Yes," said Strike,
the blood pounding in his ears.
"Please tell her I said goodbye when she wakes up. I'm going to have to leave now."
They walked together down the comfortable passageway.
"Lady Bristow seems very ill," Strike commented.
"Oh, yes, she is," said the nurse. "She could die any time now. She's very poorly."
"I think I might have left my,"
said Strike vaguely, wandering left into the yellow sitting room he had first visited, leaning over the sofa to block the nurse's view, and carefully replacing the telephone receiver he had taken off the hook.
"Yes, here it is," he said,
pretending to palm something small and put it in his pocket.
"Well, thanks very much for the coffee."
With his hand on the door, he turned to look at her.
"Her Valium addiction's as bad as ever, then," he said.
Unsuspicious, trusting, the nurse smiled a tolerant smile.
"Yes, it is," but it can't hurt her now. Mind you, she said, I'd give those doctors a piece of my mind. She's had three of them giving her prescriptions for years, from the labels on the boxes.
Very unprofessional, said Strike. Thanks again for the coffee. Goodbye.
He jogged down the stairs, his mobile already out of his pocket, so exhilarated that he did not concentrate on where he was going, so that he took a corner on the stair and let out a bellow of pain as the prosthetic foot slipped on the edge. His knee twisted and he fell, hard and heavy, down six stairs, landing in a heap at the bottom, with an excruciating fiery pain in both the joint and the end of his stump, as though it was freshly severed, as though the scar tissue was still healing.
Fuck! Fuck!
Are you all right?
Shouted the Macmillan nurse, gazing down at him over the banisters, her face comically inverted.
I'm fine! Fine! He shouted back. Slipped! Don't worry!
Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!
He moaned under his breath, as he pulled himself back to his feet on the newel post, scared to put his full weight on the prosthesis. He limped downstairs, leaning on the banisters as much as possible, half hopped across the lobby floor, and hung on to the heavy front door as he manoeuvred himself out onto the front steps. The sporting children were receding in a distant crocodile, pale and navy blue, winding their way back to their school and lunch. Strike stood leaning against warm brick, cursing himself fluently and wondering what damage he had done. The pain was excruciating, and the skin that had already been irritated felt as though it had been torn. It burned beneath the gel pad that was supposed to protect it, and the idea of walking all the way to the underground was miserably unappealing. He sat down on the top step and phoned a taxi, after which he made a further series of calls, firstly to Robin, then to Wardle, then to the offices of Landry, May, Patterson. The black cab swung around the corner. For the very first time, it occurred to Strike how like miniature hearses they were, these stately black vehicles, as he hoisted himself upright and limped in escalating pain down to the pavement.
Part 5. Felix qui portuit rerum cognoscere causas. Lucky is he who has been able to understand the causes of things. Virgil, Georgics, Book 2.
Chapter 1. I'd have thought, said Eric Wardle slowly, looking down at the will in its plastic pocket, you'd have wanted to show this to your client first.
I would, but he's in Rye, said Strike, and this is urgent. I've told you I'm trying to prevent two more murders. We're dealing with a maniac here, Wardle.
He was sweating with pain. Even as he sat here, in the sunlit window of the Feathers, urging the policeman to action, Strike was wondering whether he might have dislocated his knee or fractured the small amount of tibia left to him in the fall down Yvette Brewster's stairwell. He had not wanted to start fiddling with his leg in the taxi, which was now waiting for him at the curb outside. The meter was eating steadily away at the advance Bristow had paid him, of which he would never receive another instalment, for today would see an arrest, if only Wardle would rouse himself.
I'll grant you this might show motive.
Might, repeated Strike. Might! 10 million might constitute a motive, for fucks. But I need evidence that will stand up in court, and you haven't bought me any of that. I've just told you where you can find it. Have I been wrong yet? I told you it was a fucking will, and there, Strike jabbed the plastic sleeve, it fucking is. Get a warrant.
Wardle rubbed the side of his handsome face, as though he had toothache, frowning at the will.
Jesus Christ, said Strike. How many more times? Tansy Bastigui was on the balcony. She heard Landry say, I've already done it.
You put yourself on very thin ice there, mate, said Wardle. Defence makes mincemeat of lying to suspects. When Bastigui finds out there aren't any photos, he's going to deny everything.
Let him. She won't. She's right to tell anyway. But if you're too much of a pussy to do anything about this, Wardle, said Strike, who could feel cold sweat on his back
and a fiery pain in what remained of his right leg. And anyone else who was close to Landry turns up dead. I'm going to go straight to the fucking press. I'll tell him I gave you every bit of information I had, and that you had every fucking chance to bring this killer in. I'll make up my fee in selling the rights to my story, and you can pass that message on to Carver for me. Here, he said, pushing across the table a piece of torn paper, on which he had scribbled several six-figure numbers. Try them first. Now get a fucking warrant. He pushed the will across the table to Wardle, and slid off the high barstool. The walk from the pub to the taxi was agony. The more pressure he put on his right leg, the more excruciating the pain became. Robin had been calling Strike every 10 minutes since 1 o'clock, but he had not picked up. She rang again as he was climbing, with enormous difficulty, up the metal stairs towards the office, heaving himself up with the use of his arms. She heard his ringtone echoing up the stairwell, and hurried out onto the top landing.
"There you are! I've been calling and calling, there's been loads—"
"What's the matter? Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he lied.
"No, you—" "What's happened to you?"
She hastened down the stairs towards him. He was white and sweaty, and looked, in Robin's opinion, as though he might be sick.
"Have you been drinking?"
"No, I haven't been bloody drinking," he snapped. "I've—" "Sorry, Robin. In a bit of pain here. I just need to sit down."
"What's happened? Let me—"
"I've got it. No problem. I can manage."
Slowly, he pulled himself to the top landing and limped very heavily to the old sofa. When he dropped his weight into it, Robin thought she heard something deep in the structure crack and noted, "We'll need a new one." And then, "But I'm leaving."
"What happened?"
she asked.
"I fell down some stairs," said Strike, panting a little, still wearing his coat. "Like a complete tit."
"What stairs? What happened?"
From the depths of his agony he grinned at her expression, which was part horrified, part excited.
"I wasn't wrestling anyone, Robin, I just slipped."
"Oh, I see. You're a bit... you look a bit pale. You don't think you could have done something serious, do you? I could get a cab. Maybe you should see a doctor."
"No need for that. Have we still got any of those painkillers lying around?"
She bought him water and paracetamol. He took them, then stretched out his legs, flinched and asked,
"What's been going on here? Did Graham Hardacre send you a picture?"
"Yes,"
she said, hurrying to her computer monitor. "Here." With a shunt of her mouse and a click, the picture of Lieutenant Jonah Aguman filled the monitor. In silence, they contemplated the face of a young man whose irrefutable handsomeness was not diminished by the overlarge ears he had inherited from his father. The scarlet, black and gold uniform suited him. His grin was slightly lopsided, his cheekbones high, his jaw square, and his skin dark with an undertone of red, like freshly brewed tea. He conveyed the careless charm that Lula Landry had had too, the indefinable quality that made the viewer linger over her image.
"He looks like her," said Robin in a hushed voice.
"Yeah, he does. Anything else been going on?"
Robin seemed to snap back to attention.
"Oh, God, yes. John Bristow called 30 minutes ago to say he couldn't get hold of you, and Tony Landry's called 3 times.
"I thought he might. What did he say?"
"He was absolutely... well, the first time he asked to speak to you, and when I said you weren't here, he hung up before I could give him your mobile number. The second time he told me you had to call him straight away, but slammed down the phone before I could tell him you still weren't back. By the third time he was just, well, he was incredibly angry, screaming at me."
"He'd better not have been offensive," said Strike, scowling.
"He wasn't really. Well, not to me. It was all about you."
"What did he say?"
"He didn't make a lot of sense, but he called John Bristow a stupid prick, and then he was bawling something about Alison walking out, which he seemed to think had something to do with you, because he was yelling about suing you and defamation and all kinds of things."
"Alison's left her job?"
"Yes."
"Did he say where she—"
"No, of course he didn't. Why would he know?" he finished, more to himself than to Robin. He looked down at his wrist. His cheap watch seemed to have hit something when he had fallen downstairs, because it had stopped at 1:45.
"What's the time?"
10 to 5.
"Already?"
"Yes. Do you need anything? I can hang around a bit."
"No, I want you out of here."
His tone was such that instead of going to fetch her coat and handbag, Robin remained exactly where she was.
"What are you expecting to happen?"
Strike was busy fiddling with his leg, just below the knee.
"Nothing. You've just worked a lot of overtime lately. I'll bet Matthew will be glad to see you back early for once."
There was no adjusting the prosthesis through his trouser leg.
"Please, Robin, go," he said, looking up.
She hesitated, then went to fetch her trench coat and bag.
"Thanks," he said. "See you tomorrow."
She left. He waited for the sound of her footsteps on the stairs before rolling up his trouser leg, but heard nothing. The glass door opened, and she reappeared. "You're expecting someone to come," she said, clutching the edge of the door, "aren't you?"
"Maybe," said Strike, "but it doesn't matter."
He mustered a smile at her tight, anxious expression.
"Don't worry about me."
When her expression did not change, he added, "I boxed a bit in the army, you know." Robin half laughed.
"Yes, you mentioned that."
"Did I?"
"Repeatedly. That night you know."
"Oh, right. Well, it's true."
"But who are you?"
"Matthew wouldn't thank me for telling you. Go home, Robin. I'll see you tomorrow."
And this time, albeit reluctantly, she left. He waited until he heard the door onto Denmark Street bang shut, then rolled up his trouser leg, detached the prosthesis, and examined his swollen knee and the end of his leg, which was inflamed and bruised. He wondered exactly what he had done to himself, but there was no time to take the problem to an expert tonight. He half wished now that he had asked Robin to fetch him something to eat before she left. Clumsily, hopping from spot to spot, holding onto the desk, the top of the filing cabinet, and the arm of the sofa to balance, he managed to make himself a cup of tea. He drank it sitting in Robin's chair, and ate half a packet of digestives, spending most of the time in contemplation of the face of Jonah Aguman. The paracetamol had barely touched the pain in his leg. When he had finished all the biscuits, he checked his mobile. There were many missed calls from Robin, and 2 from John Bristow. Of the 3 people who Strike thought might present themselves at his office this evening, it was Bristow he hoped would make it there first. If the police wanted concrete evidence of murder, his client alone, though he might not realise it, could provide it. If either Tony Landry or Alison Creswell turned up at his offices, "I'll just have to..." Then Strike snorted a little in his empty office, because the expression that had occurred to him was, "think on my feet." But 6 o'clock came, and then 5:30, and nobody rang the bell. Strike rubbed more cream into the end of his leg, and reattached the prosthesis, which was agony. He limped through into the inner office, emitting grunts of pain, slumped down in his chair, and, giving up, took the false leg off again, and slid down to lay his head on his arms, intending to do no more than rest his tired eyes. Chapter 2 Footsteps on the metal stairs. Strike sat bolt upright, not knowing whether he had been asleep 5 minutes or 50. Somebody rapped on the glass door.
"Come in, it's open," he shouted,
and checked that the unattached prosthesis was covered by his trouser leg. To Strike's immense relief, it was John Bristow who entered the room, blinking through his thick-lensed glasses and looking agitated.
"Hi, John. Come and sit down."
But Bristow strode towards him, blotchy-faced, as full of rage as he had been the day that Strike had refused to take the case, and gripped the back of the offered chair instead.
"I told you," he said,
the colour waxing and waning in his thin face as he pointed a bony finger at Strike.
"I told you quite clearly that I didn't want you to see my mother without me present."
I know you did, John, but she's unbelievably upset. I don't know what you said to her, but I've had her crying and sobbing down the phone to me this afternoon.
I'm sorry to hear that.
She didn't seem to mind my questions when...
She's in a dreadful state! Shouted Bristow, his buck teeth glinting. How dared you go and see her without me? How dared you?
Because, John, as I told you after Rochelle's funeral, I think we're dealing with a murderer who might kill again, said Strike. The situation's dangerous, and I want an end to it.
You want an end to it? How do you think I feel?
Shouted Bristow, and his voice cracked and became a falsetto.
Do you have any idea how much damage you've done? My mother's devastated, and now my girlfriend seems to have vanished into thin air, which Tony is blaming on you. What have you done to Alison? Where is she?
I don't know. Have you tried calling her?
She's not picking up. What the hell's been going on? I've been on a wild goose chase all day, and I come back.
Wild goose chase? Repeated Strike, surreptitiously shifting his leg to keep the prosthesis upright. Bristow threw himself onto the seat opposite, breathing hard and squinting at Strike in the bright evening sun streaming in through the window behind him. Somebody, he said furiously, called my secretary up this morning, purporting to be a very important client of ours in Rye, who was requesting an urgent meeting. I travelled all the way there to find that he's out of the country and nobody had called me at all. Would you mind, he added, raising a hand to shield his eyes, pulling down that blind? I can't see a thing.
Strike tugged the cord, and the blind fell with a clatter, casting them both into a cool, faintly striped gloom.
That's a very strange story, said Strike. It's almost as though somebody wanted to lure you away from town.
Bristow did not reply. He was glaring at Strike, his chest heaving.
I've had enough, he said abruptly. I'm terminating this investigation. You can keep all the money I've given you. I've got to think of my mother.
Strike slid his mobile out of his pocket, pressed a couple of buttons, and laid it on his lap.
Don't you even want to know what I found today in your mother's wardrobe?
You went... You went inside my mother's wardrobe?
Yeah. I wanted to have a look inside those brand new handbags Lula got the day she died.
Bristow began to stutter.
You...
The bags have got detachable linings. Bizarre idea, isn't it? Hidden under the lining of the white bag was a will. Handwritten by Lula on your mother's blue notepaper, and witnessed by Rochelle on Ifade. I've given it to the police.
Bristow's mouth fell open. For several seconds he seemed unable to speak. Finally he whispered,
But what did it say?
That she was leaving everything, her entire estate, to her brother, Lieutenant Jonah Aguman of the Royal Engineers.
Jonah... Who?
Go and look on the computer monitor outside. You'll find a picture there.
Bristow got up and moved like a sleepwalker towards the computer in the next room. Strike watched the screen illuminate as Bristow shifted the mouse. Aguman's handsome face shone out of the monitor, with his sardonic smile, pristine in his dress uniform.
Oh my God, said Bristow.
He returned to Strike and lowered himself back into the chair, gaping at the detective.
I can't believe it.
That's the man who was on the CCTV footage, said Strike, running away from the scene the night that Lula died. He was staying in Clerkenwell with his widowed mother while he was on leave. That's why he was hot-footing it along Theobald's Road 20 minutes later. He was heading home.
Bristow drew breath in a loud gasp.
They all said I was deluded,
he almost shouted.
But I wasn't bloody deluded at all.
No, John, you weren't deluded, said Strike. Not deluded. More like batshit insane.
Through the shaded window came the sounds of London, alive at all hours, rumbling and growling, part man, part machine. There was no noise inside the room, but Bristow's ragged breathing.
"Excuse me," he said, ludicrously polite.